The following is an audio podcast from the Korea Society, celebrating 50 years of promoting greater awareness, understanding, and cooperation between the people of the United States and Korea. For more information on our programs, please visit our website at www.koreasociety.org.
On April 1st, 2008, Evans J.R. Revere, President of the Korea Society, moderated a panel with Zarin Mehta, President and Executive Director of the New York Philharmonic, Daniel J. Watkin, Cultural Reporter for the New York Times, and Chuck R. Lustig, Director of Foreign News for ABC News, in which they discussed the New York Philharmonic's February performance in North Korea, as well as the events that led to the historic event.
Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Korea Society. It's a delight to have you all here in such great numbers. We have a very special program for you this evening, which I think you'll find most enjoyable, and we'll try to provide some entertainment along the way as well. I'm Evans Revere, the president of the Korea Society, and I want to issue a small welcome, welcome to all of you for coming into our small room, which we we'll manage to pack to the gills, I suspect, before the evening is out. Hopefully everyone will be able to get a seat. As I said, it's a very special program, and it's a program involving some interesting reminiscences about a fascinating trip that all of us here on the stage took not that long ago. And let me just begin by saying, imagine yourself, if you've been away on another planet for the last 3 or 4 months, if you were to come into the room this evening and I were to tell you that on the 26th of February, the New York Philharmonic Orchestra played a concert in Pyongyang, and during the course of the concert, the DPRK allowed the American flag to be flown on the stage, the American national anthem to be played, and that 1,500 people or so who were in the hall, most of them DPRK citizens, stood up and stood at rigid attention as the American national anthem was played, and that the DPRK allowed the concert to be live broadcast to all of its citizens in a country that has been taught that America is an evil power and its arch enemy for the last 60 years. If I were to tell you that, you would look at me, if you had come from another planet, and say, "It's April 1st, you are obviously kidding." All of that took place, and more. And beyond that, several of us not only participated in the event, but managed to get permission from the North Korean government to cross the demilitarized zone from south to north and drive through North Korea to participate in the concert, something that has virtually no precedent. All of these things and much more happened on the 26th of February, a cold but beautiful day in Pyongyang. And we are here to talk about that and more this evening. We at the Korea Society were very proud to have played a small role in bringing this event back, bringing this event about, participating in the shadows, if you will, trying to bring the parties together, answering questions, providing advice and support based on a lot of experience that we've all had in traveling to the Korean Peninsula, including many trips to the northern part of the peninsula, 8 in my case. This is my 8th trip there. And North Korea is a strange and distant country in many respects for Americans. And an event like this had never been done before. And so you can imagine what just the logistical arrangements must have been like, never mind the political arrangements that needed to take place before it could happen. And so we're here this evening to talk about all of those things and more. And for the life of me, I can't imagine a better group of people to be on the podium with here on the stage here this evening than the gentleman to my left. On my immediate left to join us in this discussion is the president and executive director of the New York Philharmonic, Mr. Zarin Mehta. To his left is Mr. Chuck Lustig, who's the director of foreign news of ABC News. And last and certainly not least is Daniel Wakin, the culture reporter of the New York Times. All of us were in Pyongyang for this remarkable event, and all of us are here to talk for a few minutes about our shared experiences and our individual experiences in that event. And then after a conversation for a short while, we'll open it up and take your questions. Hopefully we'll have a most interesting evening and a most revealing evening. Let me, if I can, taking advantage of my position here as moderator, and begin the conversation by just throwing out a few questions. And let me begin, President Maeda, if I can, with you. I wonder if you could share with the audience, just for a few moments, how this all came about, the invitation, the negotiations, the preparations, et cetera. When did it all begin? And give us the 2 or 3 minute version, if you could.
Well, the first we heard about it was our public relations department, our director of public relations, Eric Latsky, is here. He came up to my office and said that we have a call from a news agency in South Korea saying we've been invited to play in Pyongyang, and we both looked at each other and laughed.
And it wasn't even April 1st.
That's right. We didn't know what to make of it, and we sort of put everything aside. And then this was repeated a couple of weeks later. We checked with the State Department through some contacts that we both had, and the State Department said, yes, they've heard this is going to happen, or was going to be the case, and they didn't see anything wrong with it. And my reaction was, it's got to be stronger than we don't see anything wrong with it. So we again put it aside, and this time the mission to the United Nations from North Korea got in touch with us about it, and this was getting more serious and more prevalent. So we called the State Department again, and this time, and this is about 3 weeks later, just after Labor Day last year, that the State Department official told Eric that they would provide total logistical and diplomatic support if he thought it was a good idea to play there, but the decision was the New York Philharmonics. So we decided at that stage that we should meet with the ambassador, and he came to our offices, and that's the first time we met because he brought you along as bodyguards, I guess. The ambassador and Fred Carrier and Evans met with Eric and I, and they presented us with a document with a stamp or a seal of the Ministry of Culture from Pyongyang. And the letters DPRK became ingrained in my mind for the first time. And they told us why they were there. We said, well, we don't know quite how to do this. Pyongyang is not something that we can just go to. We are not planning on going to Seoul for at least another 2 years as part of our Asian tours. And they said, no, we don't want to wait that long. We think you should come by the end of November. They didn't quite understand that we are not a totalitarian regime that can say to the New York Philharmonic, go. I'm not sure how we proceeded quite after that. I think we talked to Washington again. We talked a few times. And looking at my schedule, I said, well, we are in Asia in February of 2008, playing in Hong Kong and ending up in Beijing. And as it happens, we have in our sort of very tight schedule a couple of days that we could use to go to Pyongyang before we return to New York. But how do we do this logistically? Normally speaking, when you travel somewhere, there's regularly scheduled airline flights, cargo flights, hotels, etc. And the reaction of the North Korean ambassador was, everything can be arranged. So we decided to make a fact-finding trip. There we are. That's how it all started. We talked to our orchestra musicians. They were, of course, extremely concerned, as I was. There was political reasons to question it. There were logistical reasons. Did they have hotels? Did they have halls? What was the food like? What was the medical situation? All those logistical things that we look at when we go anywhere in the world. That had to be considered. We had to find out who was going to pay for this. We realized that this is not something we were going to go and make money on. Normally, we look to see who sponsors are. In China, we had Credit Suisse as our sponsor. We immediately figured out they had no business in Pyongyang, so they wouldn't sponsor us. But there were silly things like that. I mean, we were frankly having a good time thinking about it. And, you know, in the meantime, our season in September opened with a gala with Yo-Yo Ma. You know, it sort of, life was going on. And Ambassador Hill, who was the Undersecretary of State looking after the negotiations with the North Koreans, came at our request and had a meeting with me for a couple of hours and convinced us of the soundness of the decision if you could find a way to go there and what it might do to the furtherance of the non-proliferation talks. That was pretty heavy going for us, and we said, well, we will look at it seriously. We arranged to go to Pyongyang. We took a member of our orchestra, Fred Carrier from the Korea Society, Yuri Kim from the State Department, Eric and myself, one of my staff members, a production person, and our travel agent. We found out that there were only 3 flights a week to Pyongyang from Beijing and 3 flights out. And we didn't know quite how the orchestra would fit into that. Besides, I knew that we would not be going in Ilyushin jets to North Korea. But we had our visas. We flew to Beijing. Just as we landed, and we did this very secretly. Only a few people on our board knew about it. Nobody on my staff knew about it. And we arrived in Beijing on a Friday afternoon or Thursday afternoon. And there was an email saying that one of South Korean news agencies knew that we were taking the Saturday morning flight to Pyongyang. So there was the secret. I think, Evans, you told me that the best way to keep a secret in Korea is to tell the U.S. Embassy what you're doing. And we said, well, look, if this is out...
I was hoping you wouldn't quote me on that one.
Then we arrived there, and when this happened, we said, well, if this is out, everybody's going to talk about it. And so we picked up the phone and called Dan from Beijing and said, the New York Times will be a little upset if we don't talk to them about this, and it's all over the world. So we talked from the hotel room in Beijing. The next day, we got our visas from the North Korean embassy, flew to Pyongyang, and we'd reserved in one of their hotels. And when we landed, we were told that we were not staying in the hotel, that we were going to be housed in their government guest house, which people who knew the thing told me that that's only for heads of state. And we were being put there, this is very important. And that's, frankly, for 5 days, that's how we were treated. I mean, I can go into enormous detail about it. But suffice it to say at this stage that it became pretty obvious to us that they were taking this extremely seriously. I mean, we were too, but they wanted this to happen. And it had also become very obvious to us from the dealings with the mission of the United Nations and from the few hours we spent with them when we arrived that this is a group that is fundamentally has grown up doing what it's been told to do. There's a discipline and an ability to get things done. And I decided that I wasn't going to negotiate with them. I wasn't going to be unreasonable, but I would be extremely clear that if he came, these certain factors had to fall into place. Otherwise, there was no point in us coming. And frankly, that's how I can say from there to the end, everything worked very smoothly. And I wasn't surprised with anything there, frankly.
Let me ask you about this negotiation before turning to our other panelists with a couple of other questions. As a former U.S. diplomat, as somebody who served on the Korean Peninsula for many years and a student of Korean history, it occurred to me that the last time there were that many Americans in North Korea and the last time the American flag was flown so prominently in North Korea. I believe it was the U.S. Marine 7th Division, and it was probably October of 1950, and the Marines were heading towards the Chinese border. How difficult was it to get the North Koreans to agree to the flags and the anthems and the numbers that you were planning to bring up there?
You see, I was not saddled with history. It was, you know, it was not difficult because, as I said, it became obvious they wanted to do this. And I said, if you're going to do it, we need to do certain things correctly. There was a lot of criticism, as you know, when we came back, all people saying, we're going to pander to the regime, they will tell us what to play, etc. This never even crossed their minds. I didn't discuss what we were going to play with for them. I said, when we go to a foreign country like this, we always play our anthem, and we intend to play our anthem and your anthem. And they nodded. That was the reaction to everything. In a sense, they were reasonable. You know, I didn't expect anything different. So I never had to argue about anything or insist. I have to say, the only one thing that I set out from the start, well, let me tell you a little anecdote. When we arrived, they had an itinerary for 4 or 5 days for us. The morning of Sunday was to look at the hall and a hotel, and the rest of the time was to visit their monuments, visit the SS Pueblo and where the great leader was born, etc. And I said, no, we're not going to do any of that. I didn't want to be a tourist for 5 days. I said, we're going to work, we're going to look at halls, I want to see your music education, your conservatories, etc. And they all went into a meeting, and then 2 hours later they had revised the whole schedule. And we went to see lots of halls, and we went to see hotels. I was making a point enough. Yeah, so when we arrived there, it was obvious that they were going to do what we wanted them to do because they didn't know what it was to put on a concert. They said, this is your business. What you play is your business. They were extremely correct about it.
Well, having spent probably thousands of hours seated across the table from DPRK diplomats in negotiations about nuclear and missile and other matters over the years, I marveled at how easy, at the fact that they were putty in your hands as you managed to get them to
agree to all of these things. They wanted us to be there. Now, precisely. You can figure out, somebody else figures out why.
We'll talk about that. We'll talk about that. Let me turn to Chuck Lustig of ABC News. It was one of the most amazing aspects of this concert, which I'm sure many of you in the room here saw, was the broadcast event. And once again, it was
sorry,
live.
That's the point I was going to make.
Please.
May I interrupt?
Please.
No, go ahead.
The only thing that they did not agree to right away was the idea that the hall that they showed us was 300 seats. I said, no, it has to be a bigger hall. We even looked at 6,000-seat halls. And I said, we want to have this concert televised. I met with their TV people, and I knew that they were not the people to do a concert. You need specialized people to do concerts. And I very quickly thought of the thing. I said, do you have HDTV? And they said, no. I said, aha, we need HDTV, so we bring people in. But I said, this has to be broadcast and telecast in your country so everybody can see it. They nodded. They didn't agree. And I think it was like 2 weeks before the concert that they finally agreed. That was the final victory for me, and the only victory, really. The rest of it was normal business. Sorry, go ahead.
No.
Well, just let the record show that those of you who are familiar with the DPRK does not do live television. The appearances by their leadership, the conferences and speeches and things that you see on television, all of that stuff is taped in advance. So not only was this unprecedented in terms of an American group coming in and broadcasting to them, but the fact that it was done live was unprecedented even in their context for their own programming. No precedent for that whatsoever. And let me turn to that issue now and talk to the issue of putting together a broadcast, bringing your people in as a representative of a major broadcast network, getting permission to do the various things that you needed to do, not only in connection with the concert, but a lot of other things that you did on the ground there. Give us a sense of the challenges that you faced and the successes and failures, if there were any.
Sure. Well, I think the greatest success was talking this man and Eric Latsky into letting us come along. Because as Zarin said, they really wanted this to be a success. They wanted us there. So the challenge for at least ABC was, well, if the North Koreans really want this to happen, we really have to get the New York Philharmonic on board to make sure they want us. So we contacted, as soon as we heard about the event, and actually it was in the New York Times, we contacted Eric Latsky, who clearly had a challenge because he was bringing in a lot of media to a place that doesn't really welcome media. And we, ABC, had been there a number of times. I've been traveling to North Korea since the early 90s. Our real great first success, though, was Bob Woodruff in 2005. Went in and we did a series of live reports and reports for World News Tonight and for Good Morning America. And actually, it was the first time the North Koreans allowed us to go live from inside their country. And they locked us into the courtyard of North Korean television and said, okay, here's the machine, here's the one cable, and here's the one phone line. Make television. And we did. And actually, it was quite successful. And then we went back in 2006 with Diane Sawyer. She broadcast from North Korea for 3 days straight, her program, Good Morning America. And then we did a one-hour documentary, which Diane voiced. So we had some history with the North Koreans, but clearly, the New York Philharmonic welcomed us and allowed us to be a part of this great adventure. I went on a trip with Zarin and Eric in January, about a month before the concert, and we sat down with the North Korean authorities, and we were going to figure out how we were going to make television. And clearly there was some expectations on their part, and there were some expectations on our part. And what we basically did was we sat around a table, we got rid of Zarin, we got rid of everyone, and the television people sat down and had a conversation. And literally, I would say 20 minutes into that conversation, because they wanted us, we were able to solve almost all the technical arrangements for ABC, NBC, CBS, and all the other television broadcasters. So it was quite successful in that regard.
Now, you did something else beyond what you've described, and that is you went into the homes of some North Korean residents to watch them watching the concert.
Yeah, everything is a negotiation, obviously, and we had a list. We presented the North Koreans when we arrived. Well, our goal was to get there as many days before the Philharmonic as possible, because what we wanted to do was a lot of television around the concert, but we knew all our competitors were going to be there. So we wanted to get there early, and we had a wish list of other things that we wanted to do. For instance, in 2005, Bob Woodruff desperately wanted to go to Yongbyon, and the North Koreans said, absolutely not, we can't. So the final...
North Korean nuclear facility, for those of you not familiar with that.
So the final night that we were there in 2005, we had a dinner with the foreign ministry, and they gave Bob a picture of some U.S. authorities from California who had visited Yongbyon. And they said, here, hold this picture until the next time you come. So the first night we got there, we reminded them of that picture in 2005, and they remembered, and they allowed Bob on the first morning that he was in North Korea to go to Yongbyon. So one of the things on our list was we wanted to go inside a house. Diane Sawyer had did that actually in 2006 when she was there, and they agreed, and we were successful in sitting with the North Korean family as the concert went on. So it was great.
Let me turn to Dan Wakin and ask you to share with the audience your impressions as a correspondent. As we were walking in the room, you said, I'm not a Korea hand. What am I doing here? And I said, all the more reason that you should be here, because as someone who didn't have a lot of experience on the peninsula, who had not dealt with this environment before, as a reporter, and also, I should add, as a musician yourself, What was your impression? What's the takeaway from this event for you?
Well, I should start out by saying, about 3 years ago, I was asked to do this job of covering classical music and dance, particularly the news in classical music. And never did I think that the news would be this big, you know, and that, you know, I'd be on the front page with the story of the Philharmonic going to North Korea. So I'm glad I took the assignment.
You don't need to thank the dear leader for this, by the way.
Yeah, that's okay. Yeah. This dear leader, I thank.
Thanks, everybody, for this.
So that's my job, is to cover, you know, music and dance in the culture department. So obviously, in any assignment like this, you bone up and you read books and clips and things. So I was familiarizing myself. When you ask what the takeaway was, I think the sensation I had was an intense version of what most journalists feel, which is you usually think you're being lied to or misled, or you have to sort through what the motivations of what someone is telling you, or, you know, what's really going on in the situation. I think we all sort of do that when we approach a story. In this case, it was that feeling tenfold. At any given moment, I didn't feel like I knew what was real and what was not real. Everything seemed so staged and put on for us that I began questioning my ability to perceive reality. And that was a sort of an unsettling feeling, but sort of fascinating. For example, I felt that the North Koreans were very consciously trying to counter some of the common tropes in reporting about North Korea. You know, starvation, there's no food, there's no heat, there's no electricity. Well, the food they laid on was unbelievable. Massive amounts of food at the banquet, as you recall. The hotel we stayed in was so overheated. The heat was blasting into the hotel rooms. And the lights were on everywhere in the hotel when we were there. But, of course, when we left, they all turned out the lights. It probably disappeared. The food disappeared, and so did the heat. So I think that was the main sensation. The other thing was the feeling of being observed and controlled at all times by the minders. And this is something that's common for any visitor to North Korea, any foreigner, I suspect. And it was an interesting dance that we held with our minders, trying to understand, you know, where they were coming from, how much of what they were saying was real or not. We didn't try to elude them because that was virtually impossible and would have been counterproductive, but we used them to try to understand a little bit about what was going on in North Korea, about what they were thinking, what North Koreans thought. Of course, it's very hard to say how real that was because these are specially selected, probably government agents, I would think. And a few little postcard impressions that have stayed with me. Include when I went to take my seat at the concert. I was rushing because I was backstage and, you know, rushing to get there in time. And one of my colleagues had a seat next to him and was saying, "Come sit here." And there was some North Korean sitting to the right of that seat. And I went to sit down in the seat, and my minder appeared like that, just as he seemed to do all the time, magically appearing. And he told the woman to my right to get up and leave, and he sat down there next to me. And that was such a vivid example of the way they control things. She didn't look too happy. She had a sort of a sour look, but there was no question of her arguing. So that's an anecdote. And another little image that I wrote about for the Week in Review afterwards that has stayed with me, and that is the last day the Philharmonic musicians played a concert with some North Korean musicians. They did the Mendelssohn Octet. It's a piece for 8 string players, and it's 2 string quartets, and there's the 4 Philharmonic musicians and 4 North Koreans, and they played. It was a very effective performance, and it was wonderful, and the audience was just like the audience at the concert, which was row upon row of very stiff, official-looking people who sat immobile, staring straight ahead with their Kim pins, except in the back row, off in the side, there was one guy following a score. And that was such a ray of hope for me, to see an actual music lover understanding what was going on and following along, and there because of the music. But that was one person. out of hundreds and hundreds.
Actually, I had that same experience because they did a rehearsal in the afternoon, and they had a number of students who were there for the rehearsal. And there were some music teachers who were clearly there, and they were clearly, you know, tapping their feet and enjoying the music. And it was nice to see North Koreans sitting in a theater enjoying music. That was quite a nice thing for me.
Well, what those of you who saw the concert may not have seen was that the day after the concert, there were also these master's classes that took place between musicians from the Philharmonic and individual young North Korean musicians who not only were they incredibly talented, but you saw these amazing connections, personal connections being made between teacher and student in the room. And I watched several of these that almost brought the group of people I was walking through the school with to tears, because you could see the human connections being made between these people and the walls of history and antipathy and horrific politics and other things between us seemed to come tumbling down in a very interesting way during those 2 or 3 hour master's classes that were taking place. Zara, let me go back to you here for a second. This question of motivation came up. North Korea is a country that has, how shall we say, a certain reputation and image internationally. It's a closed country. It is a country that has an authoritarian government. It has a reputation in the human rights arena as well. There must have been lots of concern among members of the orchestra and musicians about going there and doing this. So not only were there criticisms out in the media, but there must have been people in the orchestra who wondered whether this was the right thing to be doing. How, in the end, did most of the musicians come away after being there, after having gone through this experience? What was, on balance, their view in light of what must have been some mixed feelings as they went in?
Well, there was an extraordinary amount of debate within the musician ranks and with me and my colleagues, because it wasn't me against the musician. We all felt the same way about it. And I think over the period from October to February, things started to become more exciting for them to go and experiment, if you like, with this extraordinary regime to see what would happen. I think having been there, every single musician today, if you had to ask them, would say it was the most fantastic experience, it was the right thing to do, we did the right thing. You know, it's a totalitarian regime, but I don't know how many of you were in Eastern Europe in the 60s and 70s. It's not really any different. I mean, when I went to East Germany with an orchestra, I'm sure that the bus drivers were members of Stasi and the, you know. But once the wall came down, those were ordinary human beings suddenly. They were not horrible right-wing totalitarian policemen. And I'm sure the same thing will one day happen in North Korea. So the people that we were interacting with who were doing their job as minders, I would assume there's essential goodness in them that if somebody up there wasn't threatening them, they would become normal human beings. We just have to wait for many, many years for that to happen. It's not going to happen overnight. We know that.
There was an amazing glimpse into the normality of the audience at the very end during during the encores. I mean, right. Those of you who saw it on TV probably had a sense of this, but those of us in the room...
You didn't see it on TV because PBS cut it out.
Ah.
And I almost missed it. I'll tell you why, because, you know, we were in that front row with all the dignitaries, and our chairman and his wife and Carmen and I were ushered out with the chairman to the reception room to say goodbye to him. In the meantime, the applause is going on and everybody's waving and we're missing it all.
Well, not only was there an extended 10 or 12 minute standing ovation in which the musicians almost couldn't get off the stage, many of them are actually wandering back out on the stage to respond to the applause, many of the North Koreans were standing up not only applauding and cheering, but they were in tears at the end of that concert. Once again, let me remind you, this is April 1st, but this really happened.
Well, the minder that sat down next to me,
yes,
after the orchestra played Arirang and there was the cheering and the waving, for the first time I saw him genuinely moved. And I was convinced that his reaction was truly genuine. He said, "My heart is booming," was the phrase he used. And he was really moved. And this was a fairly tough character. He wasn't, he was not easy. He was not an easy person. And that was a genuine moment. I felt that I had struck reality at that point.
The last thing that we did before heading to the airport was to sit in on one of these master's classes with a woodwind player. And the fellow who took us on the tour of the school was the party chief of the school, who was, as my wife described him, as red as they come. And he took us on this tour. And as we were all watching this encounter between this middle-aged American woodwind player and this young 18 or so year old young North Korean musician, it was incredibly moving. And I looked at him out of the corner of my eye, and you could see that he was also moved by this experience. It was quite something. Chuck, let me get back to you for a second here and ask you, you've been to North Korea any number of times, lots of experience up there. What was your sense of the changes that you had seen from your first visit to your most recent experience up there with the Philharmonic?
I think the main thing that the first time I went to North Korea, I went in the early 1990s, and then I went back again in the late 1990s, and then I was there three times in 2005, and then once in 2006, and then and this time. What I see is a trickle down that has occurred over the years. I've traveled all around the country. I've been to the Sea of Japan. I've been down south. I've been to the mountains. And the sense I get every time I go is that North Koreans are just a little better off every time that I go, that their shoes are a little bit better, that they have socks, that their clothes are a little bit neater. Even out in the countryside, even with the peasants, who are tending the rice fields, there is a sense that things are working just a little bit better, that people are eating a little bit more, that they're in Pyongyang now you can see some private street vendors selling things. So you get a sense that there's a trickle down happening and that things are getting better. And clearly the regime is trying to at least tend a little bit more to the people. I think that's the greatest thing that I see.
Isn't there an increased number of markets?
Yes,
and
there are.
Private markets, yes. Springing up in places that are being allowed to?
Yes, in the capital. I have not seen them outside the capital, but yes.
I want to turn to the audience in just a minute, but let me ask one more question of each of our panelists, the same question of each of you. I got my own view about this, but I want to hear what you have to say. Why? Why did this happen? What was the purpose of it?
The second day I was there in October, we had a meeting with Kim Gwae-gwan, which when I found out who he was, I found it rather incredulous that he is an orchestra manager meeting with probably the second or third most powerful person in North Korea. And it wasn't just a 15-minute, how are you? We spent 3 hours together. And I asked him that question, being totally naive, and not being a diplomat. And he said...
I know a lot of naive diplomats. Yeah.
And he said, well, you saw driving up, you didn't see too many cars. I said, no. He said, that's because we don't have any petrol, gas. And... he said, we need to get gas, we need to get heating oil. When you come in the winter, you'll see that it's cold. We don't have much electricity. And then in January, we met with his second in command, and I asked the question again. And he made a very unusual statement to me about wanting to be able to use their factories to make things for export, like a small goods manufacturer thing. And I turned to one of my colleagues and said, they want to supply Walmart. And that really is what I think they're thinking of. They want to get into the... I don't know if they know how to do it in terms of the diplomacy that's involved. They don't know how much they can trust us. That's what I would read into everything that's happening. And being a naive orchestra manager, I have many explanations to why we're doing lots of things wrong to get their dander up. I won't say any more than that.
All right. Chuck, same question.
Because Kim Jong-il wanted it to happen is the answer?
That's one
No
answer.
Question. Without him, it would not have happened.
Exactly.
No.
And nothing, I would think.
But the purpose, what was it all about?
Zarin's right. I mean, when you talk to people in the foreign ministry, that you know, they want to start opening up. They want, you know, they ask about French fast food franchises. They ask about. No, I'm serious. Actually, it's true. When I was there in January with an advanced team, we sat down with the foreign ministry. We had a little dinner of just ABC components in the foreign ministry, and you know, I was asked, "What do you think about fast food, Chuck?" You know. And it's they're beginning to think about the future and the future of the country. But in terms of why this event, I don't think anyone can answer that. You know, that place is still such a mystery. And no one knows why Kim Jong-il makes decisions that he makes. You know, everyone would like to think they're an expert on the country. And there are a lot of experts on North Korea, I've learned over the years. But I don't think anyone is really a true expert. I really think that's the one country in the world today where it's impossible to know why many of the decisions are made.
Fair enough.
Absolutely. You know, it's in a curious sort of way, it's a something of an anachronism to do this. And it takes an isolated country to think that somehow classical music, and you know, please forgive me, can have a big impact like that, because the world has changed a lot. And, you know, in 1973, the Philadelphia Orchestra went to China, and that really was a big deal. And maybe they were thinking back in that mindset that this would have the same kind of effect. I look at it as being actually a wonderful moment for classical music. It was so exciting to see a classical music as part of the daily currency of the front page of the newspaper, part of the daily conversation, part of what people at home were talking about, and not just people who go to concerts, but everybody. So maybe that has something to do with it. Maybe they're thinking about China. Maybe they're thinking about the Soviet Union. I don't know, as a way of somehow showing a softer face to the world at a time when they're, you know, they're negotiating over the reactor.
Or someone said to me today, maybe the North Koreans wanted to hear the greatest orchestra in the world come to North Korea and play the North Korean national anthem.
And they did a really good
quite
job.
Quite possible.
I'm going to use that for another 20 years.
Well, as a former military man and as a former American diplomat, standing in that hall that evening and watching every single North Korean stand at rigid attention as our national anthem was being played, I thought I was in a different galaxy that night. It was just an amazing experience. Before turning to the audience, just one comment, and that is that just before our program this evening, I was in my office reading a 9-page blast that came out of Pyongyang directed at Seoul. You may have seen some reporting on this in the last day or so, but it was a very, very strongly worded statement with a lot of hyperbolic rhetoric in it. I learned lots of new Korean vocabulary. I thought I knew a lot of good words, but I learned a lot more a little bit earlier. One of the only positive sentences in the entire 9 pages is about this concert. Really? Interestingly enough, in that entire 9 pages, it was quite something.
That's one of the few references they've made publicly since, right?
Yes.
There was a little article in the newspaper the next day praising Lauren Mazel, the music director, as conducting.
Yes.
And that was about it, right?
Yeah. One of my areas of expertise is analyzing the propaganda of communist countries, and I spent most of the last 30-odd years analyzing North Korean and Chinese propaganda. And to open the newspaper, as we did the next day after the concert, and read a perfectly non-controversial, straight news report about an event that took place in North Korea was almost unprecedented. Mm-hmm. It was that. It was just a straight piece of reportage about what happened. No commentary, no spin, just the facts.
Well, that's because there was no visit to the pig farm that day. And when you read the North Korean newspaper, the first thing you read usually on the front page is about the great leader's visit to a pig farm or a factory number 9, where he gave guidance to the to the workers.
Well, it was good to have some culture, even if it was on page four. We're going to open it up to questions. I do ask, wait for the microphone as it comes around. I'll see if I can sort of point to people as you ask questions. Please identify yourself. Please ask a question. We don't have that much time. We don't want to be any speeches. And if there is a particular member of the panel that you would like your question to be directed to, please direct it to him. So why don't we'll start right here, ladies first, and then we'll move back, and I promise to get to the folks in the back.
Hi, I'm Jean Golden. I'm so glad to be here, and I just want to ask you, what percentage of the people in North Korea speak English?
That's probably a question I should try to ask.
I don't know. I mean,
it is a requirement in many high schools and universities, along with two or three other major languages. My goodness. Of all the North Korean diplomats that I've met in various contexts, I'd say about 80%+ of them speak English. They also speak a number of other languages. Conversational English, I'd say it's a fairly small portion of the population. South Korea, it's fairly widespread, although conversationally it's not that high in terms of their skill level, but a lot of people have a smattering of English. I think it's probably a heck of a lot lower in the DPRK. But certainly all of the elites who do any overseas travel, including their diplomats and some of their other ministry officials, will have at least a smattering of English, enough to sort of read signs and read headlines and that sort of thing. But it is a required course in many of the curricula in the DPRK.
Just in all my travels outside of Pyongyang, the only people I have met that spoke English were people who were associated as tour guides or things like that. I've never met anyone outside the capital who was not a tour guide who spoke any
English. When I'm outside of Pyongyang, I always speak Korean. I don't even bother with English because you know you're not going to get very far with it.
Every person I dealt with only spoke Korean. Except the main person I was dealing with, he spoke French for some reason. Otherwise, we spoke English through our translators, and I spoke French with this individual.
Well, I imagine it's difficult for them to study English because they can't leave the country and go to an English-speaking country. And the instructors are probably mostly North Korean and those that can be trusted.
No, actually, they have a fair number of Europeans and Eastern Europeans
teaching English.
Language institutes teaching many languages, including English.
And but they're not native English speakers, so
in some cases they are, and you'll often run into DPRK diplomats, North Korean diplomats, who actually speak English with a British accent, which tells you something about where their training came from.
Well, actually, I learned this from BBC tapes. Actually, yes. in BBC language tapes.
Yes. Good question. Third row, right here. Yes, in the middle.
My name is Josetta Capriati. I'm Italian. I'm an international public relations person. I stayed up all night to watch the concert on TV. It was fascinating, one of the most memorable experiences of my life. But I was just shocked the day after to hear. In fact, my question is to you because you were a U.S. diplomat, the head of the Asia Department at the State Department. How come the State Department played down this very, very important event? Why did they do that?
Yeah, why did they do that?
Let the record show that she said, I used to be an American diplomat. To be fair, I think Zarin has already touched on this. There were extensive contacts with the State Department, and in our case, with the State Department and other agencies of the U.S. government, in which there was very clearly support for what it was that we were doing together. So there was never any doubt, in my mind at least, that we did have the support of the United States government in doing this. My own sense is that if you remember the political environment that existed around the 26th of February, things in the six-party talks were not going all that well. There was the question of the North Korean declaration in the six-party talks, the declaration of their past nuclear activities, in which the North Koreans were supposed to have submitted that at the end of December and still have not as of today. Lots of other issues in connection with this. My sense is that people in Washington looked at this and said, while we are willing to allow this to go forward, we're not willing to take the extra step and say anything more than we've already said about this. And there was an interesting mix of comments about this, including some not very helpful comments from my former boss. She will go unnamed. I did note that a couple of days after the event, Chris Hill said something that was actually fairly positive that seemed to contradict what his boss had said. There was an unhelpful comment from the White House. It was not a really negative comment, but it didn't help. No, you're exactly right. I think the political environment, such as it was, prompted people in the administration not to say in public what they were certainly saying in private to us. And I was disappointed. Others were disappointed. A number of the musicians that I talked to in Pyongyang were very disappointed because they felt that they had stuck their necks out, so to speak, literally and figuratively, in going to Pyongyang and participating in this event. And they thought that they had deserved more credit than they eventually got. I think the musicians, to a person, handled themselves magnificently. And I have written a letter to the musicians on my own behalf, speaking as a former diplomat, writing the letter that I would have written had I been in the State Department, and telling them that as a person with 35 years of diplomatic experience, what I thought about what they did. And what I said to them was, I thought some of the best diplomacy that I have ever witnessed was the diplomacy I saw them engage in, and they made America look great.
Right. But in all fairness, you know, the North Koreans didn't want to do interviews with us either. They did not want the diplomats did not want to speak on the record while we were there when the Philharmonic was visiting, because they felt they wanted to keep this a cultural event and not a diplomatic event. So
we tried to do a press conference together with them, and they didn't come. They're not used to doing press conferences. You know, we take these things for granted.
Why don't we jump all the way in the back, and then we'll come up this way. All the way in the back, standing up there. We want to give our standees an opportunity as well.
Thank you. My name is Joseph Lee, a graduate student at New York University and also intern at the Korea Society. There's absolutely no doubt this event was the most historic event in US-DPRK relations since the Korean War. Nevertheless, what I think is more important from now on is there has to be a succession or a continuation of this sort of cultural diplomacy or soft power measurement in order to maximize the positive impact the New York Phil has brought into the relations between two countries. So in this regard, I'd like to ask you if there's any information that you would like to share us about the upcoming or prospective projects that are being planned or personal ideas you might have. Sure. Thank you.
Sure. Thank you. Good question. I didn't plant this one, by the way. When we went to Pyongyang, myself, Chairman Gregg of the Korea Society, and former Secretary of Defense Bill Perry had a three-hour lunch with Vice Foreign Minister Kim Gae-gwan, the same Vice Foreign Minister that Zarin met with. He is a former counterpart of mine when I was doing negotiations between the United States and the DPRK. It was a wonderful lunch. We covered the range of issues. We disagreed about a lot of things, but we had a very straightforward and, I thought, a very helpful conversation. One of the things that came up was how can we build on this event? How can we continue the sort of cultural and scientific and academic exchanges that I think are so important if you're going to try to improve the relationship between the two countries. And we reminded him of several projects that we have started, including a project that we have been co-sponsoring with Syracuse University, and some other ideas that we had to try to further cooperation between the U.S. and the DPRK. He took all that on board, and in the weeks since then, we've gotten some very interesting signals from the DPRK that they are interested in building on those previous exchanges that we have sponsored, largely in the area of science and technology and computers, and expanding them possibly in the future. So that's a seed that we planted during that concert that I think is starting to sprout a bit here. We've also gotten some inquiries about the possibility of inviting a North Korean orchestra to come to the United States. once again, the same problems that we encountered in this effort obtain, logistics, money, et cetera, and politics enter into the equation as well. We are quietly exploring whether there might be some possibility of doing that. It would be extremely complicated to do, but it's not impossible to do. So at least in those two areas, there are some possibilities. Nothing specific and hard yet, but I do have a good feeling that at least in terms of academic exchanges, that some things may be moving forward in the next several weeks and months. And let's hope that the political atmosphere stays positive. That's always a difficult thing to predict. It's not my business anymore. I can't control it. But a lot of what we do depends on the political atmospherics between the two countries. And those atmospherics haven't been all that great of late, with the exception of the 26th of February. Moving up, the young lady raising her hand right there. Yes.
Hi, my name is Barbara Hawes. I'm the archivist historian at the Philharmonic, and I went along on the trip. And my question is about the young woman who was the translator for Lauren Mazel on stage that night. She was our minder and our translator on our bus, the bus we got on. We, just sort of the regular members of the orchestra, weren't assigned anybody in particular. They were just there on the bus with us. And this young woman was the most vivacious, funny, could tell jokes in English and in French. She even knew Girl Scout songs that she engaged us in on the bus. And we had so much fun with her. And then the next day when we were at the concert, I went to the rehearsal, and all of a sudden she turned out to be the interpreter for Lauren Mazel on stage. She was the face of North Korea for the world. And I asked her, I went back after, I said, "You didn't tell us last night that you were going to have this role." And she said, "I didn't know." And I said, "Well, you know, are you frightened?" And she said, "Of course not." And then the next, and she did a beautiful job. And we offered her a job to be Lauren Mazel's interpreter, because that's a hard job to do. But we thought she did a great job at that. But then at that night, though, at the reception, she came over to say goodbye. But she'd grown up. This transformation of this very young woman in those 48 hours was just remarkable. And I'm just wondering, is there any possibility that we can invite some of these people that we got to know? I know other orchestra members got to know or feel some kind of connection with the people that they had talked to on that. And I'm just, is there any way we could invite them to come and stay in touch?
Well, I don't want to monopolize the responses here, but as a former State Department person, it's difficult to do on our end, but I would also suggest it's at least as difficult on their end for people to get permission. You know, there are funding issues involved. It's a very, very complicated business. I mean, the experience that you describe of watching someone grow is an experience that I've been through maybe 20 times over the last several years, watching counterparts of mine who began their relationship with me back in the 90s by giving me hour-long speeches, unbroken speeches on Juche ideology, and pounding on the table and pointing their finger at me. And then several years later, we became drinking buddies, going out together and just chatting about our families. You know, they are human beings. We still disagree about many, many things, but they are human beings, and you can develop relationships with them even when you disagree. But going back to the main point of your question, it's difficult. It's difficult because the environment is not such that you can have the sort of free travel that we would like to see between our two countries. Part of the problem is on our end, but I would also suggest that a lot of the problem is on the DPRK's end. And I long for the day in which we can have people like that wonderful young lady who I had a chance to listen to at great length that night. Somebody apparently told your camera crew, by the way, that whenever Lauren Mazel was speaking Korean, that the camera should point at me for some reason. I don't know why, but all my friends keep telling me that we saw you on TV, but it was only in connection with every time Lauren Mazel was speaking. I long for the day when these sort of exchanges can happen, and it's one of the reasons that this organization exists, is to try to bring about some sort of reconciliation among all the parties on the Korean Peninsula, and of course the U.S. relationship with the DPRK.
I can add a couple of things
please,
to that, Barbara. The DPRK has been sending conducting students to Vienna. They sent, I think, their last batch this year, about four or five a year for the past 5 years, to study conducting. And I spoke to one of the teachers at the conservatory there who said one or two of them could have major careers if they were allowed to leave. And Joe Alessi, the principal trombonist, as you know, he did a master class, and he said his student was fantastic. He was an incredibly talented trombone player. I think you may be hearing from Mr. Alessi.
Let me add to what you go ahead. Finish.
Yeah, and he said he would love to have him come and study at Juilliard, but he just had no idea how it could possibly happen. So there's all this talent there that could really blossom if they were allowed to leave, and this is sort of a tangible aspect of the very sort of unhappy situation.
Well, what Dan was saying, Joe talked to me about it right after the master class. And he's just written me an email saying, is there any way we can bring this young man? Because it wasn't just that he is good, he is fantastic. And he really deserves, with his teacher, to come and spend a few months and getting, you know, better and knowing what our teaching methods are and so on. And we'll follow that up. But also on the conducting students, a little anecdote. When we were there in January, and as you said, you were meeting with the television people, I went off the conservatory and I took with me a list of 14 conducting students who graduated from Vienna, and I asked them if there were anybody there, can we meet them when Lauren comes, could he see them? And they took the list from me, and the next day, my translator, looked at me very seriously and said, why did you want to meet with those people? I dropped it.
Unfortunate. I spent a lot of time on university campuses making speeches about U.S.-Korea relations, and I have yet to visit a campus in which a senior leader on campus or a university professor does not come up to me and say, why can't we have students from the DPRK here? It would be a good thing. And we actually said that to our North Korean counterparts in Pyongyang. We reminded them that there are open invitations out there for this sort of thing to take place. And I'd like to see Americans headed in that direction as well. I think it would contribute significantly to breaking down some of the barriers between us. Questions? Why don't we go right here in the middle, young lady right there. Microphone's heading your way.
Good evening. I'm Yaffa Mardikaiva, and I'm from Project Bridge here at the Korea Society. And this question is for Mr. Lusting. You mentioned that you visited a Korean home, and you watched the performance, is that right?
An ABC cameraman and a producer. I was not physically there, but go ahead.
Did you ask about how that person felt watching it or that person's response to the concert?
Yeah, no, we did. We did some Q&A. Actually, we had to do it pretty quickly, though, because we had to get the tape back in order to satellite it in time for our morning program, Good Morning America. But they very much enjoyed the concert. They were very surprised that it was shown on North Korean television. But they certainly loved the music, and they loved the opportunity to be able to see it. So it was a welcome thing for the family, and they very much enjoyed it.
Gentleman with the glasses right there.
Hello there, everybody. My name is Kevin Chin. I'm a technologist for Mizuho Securities. It's a Japanese bank. I'm also involved in several Asian organizations. AKA is one of them. Susan's right next to me. She works with me at Mizuho. That's a Korean adoptee organization. And Asia Society, the little representing over there. I guess my question is, and it's already been addressed, how successful this event has been, how unprecedented this visitation of, musical friendship. What I want to ask to everybody here in the panel is, what were some of the fears that everybody felt before going into this, amazing, breaking down of barriers in a way? What were some of the things that you thought about, like, that could possibly have happened? I know it's tricky, but we'll see.
You get a very quick answer from the journalist, which is we couldn't file. that was my main fear, and you know, couldn't get the satellite feed out, couldn't get the story out.
But you did.
Oh, it was fabulous. But I was terrified of that.
There was an amazing media center there, by the way. Once again, I was responsible for, in part, for arranging Madeleine Albright's visit to North Korea way back when it happened. And we had a what passed for a media center back then, but it paled in comparison to what the North Koreans put together to support these gentlemen here. High-speed internet connections. And by the way, the speed of the internet service was higher in Pyongyang than it was in Seoul, let the record show. I walked into that media center, and this was, as I said, my eighth trip into North Korea. I have never seen anything like that before in the DPRK. I was really blown away by what I saw there.
I had no fears. I mean, once when I went in January with this advance team, and I sat down with the North Korean television technicians, and they quickly agreed to what I thought would be a good setup for all the international media. And we agreed in that, you know, 20 minutes, it was clear to me that everything was going to happen and it was going to happen just as they promised. So really, for me anyway, there was no fear in it.
Yeah, I told my musicians, I said, North Korea is probably the safest place on earth. What can go wrong?
In a manner of speaking, yes. Right there with the glasses, please, young lady.
If I could, I just want to say one other thing. When right after we had negotiated for Diane Soy to go to North Korea in 2006, and it was right after the North Koreans tested, and I thought for sure that they were going to cancel our visas and we were not going to be welcome. And sure enough, we got to Beijing, the visas were there, and we went in, you know, the next day. So my experience with the North Koreans anyway is that if they promise you they're going to do something, they're not going to want to lose face, and they're going to let you do it. So,
look, let me just give you one little anecdote. We were talking about why this came about earlier. It reminded me. We had sent them, and this happened in January, we'd send them a running order of our program and how long it would be, etc. And the last piece was Candide. And they couldn't translate that. So one of their people who was working with us came and says, "What is Candide, please?" So I told him it was the name of a person from a story of, you know. They said, "Oh." I said, "Well, who's asking?" He said, "Oh, somebody quite high up." I said, "You mean the Minister of Culture?" He said, "Oh, no, no, much higher up." I said, "You know, everything's going to work now." Sorry, I interrupted.
My name is Martha Brown. I'm a totally ordinary New Yorker who loves the New York Philharmonic.
All right.
There's nothing ordinary about you.
No, I am very, very ordinary. And for that reason, I would like to ask a question that's based on, I think, two strands of this evening's discussion. First, the observations of so many of you of the high level and high degree of training of North Korean musicians. The other strand being the availability or lack of availability of musical culture, high-level musical performance to the ordinary Korean. One thing that Mr. Mehta said a little while ago was that there are things that we take for granted that are not there in North Korea. One thing that Americans take for granted is live broadcasts, streaming, internet availability of high culture. One thing that New Yorkers take for granted, but with, I think, a sense of great gratitude, is the availability of one of the world's greatest orchestras as our local home team. If we can't afford the concerts, we can go to the open rehearsals. It's our orchestra. So one of the things I've been wondering ever since this wonderful visit to Pyongyang happened, what is the comparable availability of musical culture, performance, instruction, listening, watching, concert going to the ordinary Korean? Does it exist? Is it going to be extended, amplified as a result of this beginning of cultural musical diplomacy?
Let me, this is going to be a difficult one to answer, but let me try. I mean, in this country, with all the freedom we have and the availability of the New York Philharmonic and other organizations like CARS in the cultural field, only about 2% of our population pursues classical music or the culture of classical music. Not that much higher, trust me. I mean, you know, the New York Philharmonic has probably 40,000 households who come to our concerts. Okay? That's, and I don't think it's very much different. But without getting into that, of course it's not available generally to them. They have their own cultures, and one of the things that I saw, and I don't know if you visited the mass games, the Arirang games in years ago. In October we went to it. And you might see videos of that on television soon. They were filming it actually the night we were there. You've probably seen it. I know Fred was with us. It's the most extraordinary cultural event. And there's it runs all through the summer until the middle of October, and there's 50,000 people. That's what they go to see. They don't buy tickets. They're herded in there to witness their culture. Not excusing anything, but that's what happens. They don't have television like we have it. You know, we're going back to the days when everybody had pianos in their parlors over here. They don't have leisure time. There's no concept of leisure time in a totalitarian regime. They're told what to do from one moment to the next. When they go home, they have certain things to do. On the weekends, they have... this was taught to me by their minder, that they have meetings where they discuss how to improve themselves or how to do something for the community. That's how they think. Our international relations in the DPRK are run by the Swedish consulate or Swedish embassy. And the lady from the Swedish embassy told us that they had a 4-day vacation for some Swedish holiday, and the Swedish embassy was closed, and the North Korean employees didn't know what they were going to do with those 4 days. Again, as I repeat, you can't base it on what we do. I don't know what you've experienced in that regard.
Well, it's the elite of Pyongyang, you know, the elite class that gets to enjoy, you know, concerts, and their children get to become, if they have the talent, you know, master musicians. But you see very little else outside of the capital in that regard. Although, you know, movies are big there. They have a great filmmaking studio, and they make a lot of movies that people do see. So,
sir, right in the middle here.
Just a quick question, if I may. Richard Shager, I'm here in New York City, a lawyer. I'm curious about whether you've had any formal or informal response to the trip to North Korea from South Korea. I suspect a lot of people were very enthusiastic about it. But I'm wondering if there was anything more significant than just general citizen enthusiasm.
Let me throw out a few comments on that and then ask my colleagues to say something as well. I like to remind people that there was not just one concert on the Korean Peninsula. There were two. The orchestra went from Pyongyang to Seoul and about 36 hours or so later played a second concert in Seoul to a packed standing room only hall there. It was a wonderful, wonderful program, and I actually attended both. When I walked into the concert hall in Seoul, many people that I know, I've worked and lived in Korea for almost 8+ years, many people that I know were there, including many government officials, many former diplomats, etc. And to a person, they came up to me just raving about what they had seen, because it was broadcast live in South Korea as well, the concert in North Korea. I've had a number of discussions with South Korean government officials, media people, etc., and the reaction has been very positive, in sharp contrast to other political developments that are going on the peninsula. But I think most people recognize it for what it was, a breakthrough event in which we were able to do something inside North Korea that had never been done before, and that in and of itself was worthwhile, and that we were able to present something to the North Korean people in a channel that had been closed to us before, and they recognized the importance of that. Now, do concerts resolve political issues? Probably not, but it certainly helped the atmospherics for a short while after the 26th of February, and we'll have to see what the long-term effect is as well, but the answer to your question is pretty positive comments by most.
I got a very different, different take from in Seoul, just chatting with some people and talking to our local correspondent there, that people were much more interested in the scandal in the new government that day. They were more taken with that, and that's what they were talking about. And I talked to a few,
scandal in South Korea?
Yeah, well, shockingly, on day two of the new government. And that's what they were, and they weren't that taken, because there had been a fair amount of exchange, there had been family reunification, things had been happening over the, in recent decades. So that was what I heard.
Their attention was elsewhere. Yeah.
Don't forget that our concert in Pyongyang was one day after the new South Korean president was inaugurated, and we arrived the next day on the 27th. And there was a cocktail party that was thrown to welcome us by our sponsors, Asiana Airlines and NBC Television, and a lot of leading government people were there and businessmen. And what I got from them was rather emotional thank yous for having done that and having pulled it off. Because there's been a lot of criticism in South Korea before we went there. And as Evan said, the concert itself was an extremely moving thing. I mean, the emotional high points for me were playing the national anthem in Pyongyang, the reaction of the audience at the end of the concert in Pyongyang, and the reaction of the audience in Seoul. Very emotional.
Sir, right here.
Good evening. My name's Louis Goodmanson, and coming from the other side of the river, I'd like to say that the New York Philharmonic, in having had this experience, has been bridge building in a way that we should not ignore. And I'm hoping that the May 4th deadline of pulling the video off the internet is not really going to be followed. I'd like also to know that, there are a lot of Korean people that I meet in restaurants who still do not know that this concert occurred. And when I talk to them and exuberantly show to them a printed brochure of the program itself, because it has been posted as a PDF file, that can create tears in their eyes, just as it did in, I'm sure. So my question is, what can we do to continue the bridge building? It is so natural for us as Americans to say hello to a Korean person and speak to them about what potentially could occur if more of this were to happen. Thank you. And Americans in Paris? Americans in Paris by Gershwin, we know well from your introduction of the song. Americans in Pyongyang. That is something that I would like to see happen. Thank you.
You're talking about the video of the concert that is on our website that you can stream. But there will be an actual video DVD that's available for purchase through Channel 13 that'll be out in the next couple of weeks, and an even bigger video with documentary footage in about 2 months' time. We're not quite sure, but I think we have to take this, our streaming off, so that Channel 13 can raise some money. But I don't know how to get to the Koreans who didn't know about this concept.
Yeah, that's surprising.
I mean, maybe
more than all the Korean language newspapers in the United States and widespread coverage in the media here. Apropos the final point about what we can do. Once we flew out of Pyongyang, once we left, largely this was a job for the diplomats. Quite frankly, we created the best possible atmosphere that you could imagine for diplomacy to take place. We can solve these problems. That's not our job, but it is the job of the diplomats, and I commend them for the work that they've done. But it's now up to them, quite frankly. I'm reminded of just about a decade ago, I was supposed to be the first American diplomat to open up the U.S. Embassy in Pyongyang. And that was my assignment, and it was the North Koreans that changed their minds, not the United States back then, let the record show. That idea is still on the table. That is something that could very well happen at the end of this process that we're engaged in right now. But it's going to take a lot of hard work and a lot of creative thinking and a lot of guts on the part of all the parties involved, particularly the North Koreans.
But it's up to us to keep asking.
Yeah, it took
me 11 years to get us to do a documentary in North Korea, for the North Koreans who agreed to us to do a documentary. So if we don't ask, you don't get. So you just have to keep asking, keep pushing, and that's my lesson in all this.
I think that's also something that we achieved by the fact that we said to them right from the start that there would be a lot of press coverage. I must say that in October, I had no idea how much press coverage there would be. And I was kind of gratified to read, I think it was in the Time magazine where the man wrote that he's been trying to get into North Korea for 25 years, and because of the New York Philharmonic, he was able to go in. I think a number of press people said that. So.
Sir, right here.
David Eaton from New York. I'm a musician and applaud the Philharmonic for this great tour. two things. I read after the tour that the financing came from a wealthy Japanese woman from Italy, and I'd like to know how she entered the picture. Also, who did the arrangement of Arirang? Was it a North Korean composer? And are there composers of note there? We've heard about instrumentalists and conductors, but are there composers who we should be looking towards?
I guess I have to answer all that.
I can let Eric do it.
Yoko Cheskina is a lady that a lot of us in the international music business know. She's an extraordinary music lover, very generous all over the world. And shortly after it came out in the news that we may be going to Pyongyang, she called up and said, "Can I go with you?" And we chatted a little bit, and then about 2 months later, she was in New York. I had lunch with her, told her all about what was going on. This was in December. And she said, "Can I help in any way?" I said, "Yeah, I'm trying to raise money from my board and our patrons, etc." And so she gave us a very nice sum of money to enable us to go. We had about 25 other New Yorkers and Americans, actually, from Cleveland, San Francisco, etc., who donated money, foundations who donated money, because it's not easy to go there. And let's not forget Asiana Airlines, who it's an ask that I have never made, never expect to make again. When I asked a gentleman, I said, "Can I please borrow a 747 plane for 3 days?" And he said, "Yes." So. Not going to push my luck ever again on that. Arirang, which I had frankly never heard of. I apologize to the Koreans in the audience. In October, when we were there for our fact-finding mission, we went to a symphony concert where they played their music with a full symphony orchestra, and rather well, I thought. And they played this lovely tune. And the lady from the State Department who was with us, Yuri Kim, told me the background to this folk song. And I said, "Isn't it beautiful?" She said, "Well, you know, if the New York Philharmonic could play this, that would really cement relations and do everything." So I asked them if they had an orchestral arrangement that we could use. And as always, they sort of nodded and walked away and didn't say anything. At the airport, they handed me the parts for the North Korean national anthem and Arirang. I came back, I showed it to Lauren Mazel, and I said, "You know, it would be nice if you look it over and see if it could be done." And we did it. It was a good idea.
When Fred and I met with you in your office way back when we first started on this, I mentioned Arirang to you.
Oh, did you? Yeah.
Yes. But just one sort of comic footnote here. People were talking about the fact that there were two concerts. I don't know if you remember this, but there was an interesting difference in the presentation of Arirang in Seoul and the one in Pyongyang. It was the same score, by the way. The Arirang that was played in South Korea was the Arirang arrangement by the North Korean arranger. But I don't know if you remember what happened in the opening notes of Arirang in Seoul. Which tells you all you need to know about the high-tech environment of South Korea. a cell phone rang in the audience. Oh. You didn't hear that in Pyongyang. I was listening. Someone forgot to turn their cell phone off. This gentleman right here.
North Korea's got the most beepless society.
Exactly.
No beeps, no rings, nothing.
What anywhere. A pleasure. Yes. Just like the good old days. Please.
Thanks so much. My name is Jung Noh from Radio Free Asia. I really enjoy your discussion. My first question is very shortly. I just want to hear one more time. You had a New Philharmony had a master class in Pyongyang. So I want to hear, is there any just some planning or possibility specifically to invite talented young people to the United States and that has a class or something like that? And second question is that many people think about this concert is good chance to the North Korea move out to the world community and have a good relationship with U.S. and North Korea. But on the other hand, some people, such as North Korea defectors, something like that, think about the negative because North Korea government used this concert to the strength their regime, something like that. So you guys really think about North Korea is changing or will be changing after this concert? Yeah, thank you.
Well, I'll answer the first question, which is about masterclasses. We would be very happy, because we just said that there was at least one rather remarkable musician that we heard, and we would love to bring that person here. I'm not quite sure how to do it. We will talk to Mr. Revere and see what channels we should follow. To come for 2 or 3 months, stay here, work at Julia would be wonderful.
Well, we're certainly prepared to do whatever we can in the context of our overall mission, which is trying to build bridges wherever we can to both parts, obviously, the Korean Peninsula, and we'll see what comes of that. You know, on your second question, you mentioned the what some defectors have said. There was a remarkable interview in a Korean newspaper in Seoul. I think it was just before the concert. I was there for the inauguration of the new president in Seoul, and I read this interview with a North Korean defector who lives in South Korea today. And he was strongly urging the New York Philharmonic to go to Pyongyang. And he said it would have a powerful impact up there. And so he had a very different take on this. He thought it would be a very positive contribution. He was also a musician, by the way. And he said, I think he said something, I know something about music and the effect it can have, and this will be a very positive thing.
The only thing I could add to that is that this still remains one of the most dangerous places on Earth, that the Korean Peninsula is still one of the places, one of the few places left on this Earth where there could be a major military conflict at a moment's notice. Evans was talking about the communique that was released. One of the lines was that Seoul's tougher policies on the North could lead to catastrophic consequences. And I don't think anyone in this room or anyone can forget that a military conflict between the North and the South would be devastating not only to the peninsula but to the world. So.
When you leave Seoul by car, as we did, those of us who didn't fly into Pyongyang, you leave Seoul by car, and it's not very long before you arrive at the DMZ and you realize how close the DMZ is to the capital city of South Korea, in and around which roughly one-third of the people of South Korea, 47 million people, live in and around the capital city there. When you cross over the DMZ, as we did, we walked across the line and were almost literally handed into the arms of the KPA, the North Korean Army. And then you get in a car and you drive up north to Pyongyang. You are driving through the front lines of a potential conflict there. You can see the artillery emplacements. You can see the concrete that's been poured under which they have cannons and artillery pieces and heaven knows what more is there. Evidence of the military on both sides of the DMZ. This is an incredibly heavily fortified place. This is my third time across the DMZ, and every time I've done this, I am struck and awed and made very nervous about what I see there in terms of the armament on both sides of the DMZ today. Chuck put it perfectly. This is one of the most dangerous places on Earth,
And it's one of the reasons why I think this event was so important, because for a fleeting few hours, we changed the environment a little bit. I think we're done for the evening since the hour has arrived, but let me just close by just making a couple of remarks here in addition to what I've just said, and that is for 60-plus years, the people of North Korea have been taught what America is, and what they have been taught is a story that is sad, it's distorted, it contains some horrific statements and allegations about what we are as a people, what we are as a culture, what we are as a nation. The intensity of their propaganda directed against us over these six decades has been pretty horrific. We've said a few unkind things about them as well. We fought a war. Hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people died in that war on both sides. There's a tremendous legacy of history and enmity between the two sides. But for a few hours, thanks to the incredible skills and talents and courage of the people of the New York Philharmonic, a different image of America was portrayed to the people of North Korea. Anybody who had the opportunity to watch television, and there were hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions in North Korea who did, saw for the first time in their lives a face of America that they had been told did not exist. And so if you're asking what effect this all had, think about that. For 60 years, they have been told a particular story about who we are. But what they saw, the flags, the anthems, the tears, the music, the emotions, the talents, the skills, and the diplomacy, what they saw was a face that directly contradicted that image that they had been taught. And if that is not a diplomatic triumph, I don't know what is. Ladies and gentlemen, I want to thank you all for coming this evening, and I would like you please to join me in a round of applause thanking our excellent panelists.
Thank you for listening to this Korea Society podcast. If you enjoyed it, please consider becoming a member. Members of the Korea Society are notified of all Korea Society events, enjoy discounts on admission to programs, and a complimentary subscription to the Korea Society Journal. Membership may be purchased online at our website, www.koreasociety.org.